This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. I want to thank all of you who have been going out and starting to vote for the Magic Word Podcast as being, and myself, I guess, as being the best magic podcast in the world for this year's FISM nomination, which we had received, and also received a second nomination for the best newsletter, which I call a pod letter, that is the best magic newsletter in the world. So again, I want to thank many of you who have gone out, who have voted, and if you are hearing about this for the first time, I want to first of all then tell you, if you can have the time, just to go over to the FISM website to vote for me, and that it would be www.fismitaly2025.com/online-magic-special-awards/. Anyhow, that's kind of a longer URL, but that's the way you get to it, and there you have an opportunity to vote for all five who are in the online category, such as magazines and digital magazines and others. Anyhow, we have started to receive several people who have been voting for my podcast and the newsletter to go forward, and I want to thank all of you who have done that, and also I want to thank those of you who I anticipate, after hearing this, will go out and do this and help us move forward to win the award and bring this back from Turin, Italy here this year. First time they're doing this online award for FISM in recognizing digital creators. It's just amazing. And thank you very much, everyone who's gotten me to this position here. Well, this week, speaking of international people and international places and acts and everything, we're going to be talking with R. Paul Wilson, who is from Glasgow, Scotland, and he's going to have a delightful conversation with us and talking much about film, because that's where, aside from magic, his real passion lies. And he's also produced and directed and starred in several films and some documentaries. He has worked alongside some of the big heavy hitter A-list actors in Hollywood, like Sylvester Stallone and others, where he has helped to train them to do magic, or where his hands actually have been in the scenes in some of these movies. And we're going to talk about that. But he's also currently working on a project about the life of Juan Tamariz, which, once this comes out, is going to be amazing. He's currently got a film that's out called Our Magic, which is on YouTube, which I highly recommend. If you'll go to themagicwordpodcast.com for this week's episode, number 893, you will then see a link that you can go to Facebook and watch this. It's about an hour and 45 minutes or so, and very, very interesting, in which it features people from our community, some who have passed, like Johnny Thompson and a few others, but more importantly, just some of the advice and conversations with some of the titans of trickery from our industry. Speaking of titans of trickery, this is kind of an aside thing, but I also want to congratulate my friend John Gaspard, who happens to be a friend of the Magic Word, who helps us with his financial support and patronage. But he has also been featured on the April 2025 issue of the MUM magazine, which is the house organ of the Society of American Magicians. And he's talking about his books, Eli Marks, the mystery series, and he's got 9 of those out, in addition to a lot of other books that he has authored and other things that he has done, certainly. And this article goes into some detail about that. So congratulations, John, and also talks about his friend Jim Cunningham, who is the one who actually reads the Audible portion of the books. So if you want to actually hear the books, and that way you can buy them, which I recommend. But if you want to hear them, you actually can do that by going to Behind the Page and listening to those books. And I highly recommend it, because he always has each week some really fascinating guests. And I know that you'll enjoy not only the books, but also the conversations with other magicians, which is completely different from what this podcast does and our conversations we have with people. Continuing on with this week's conversation, though, by the way, this is one that I know you will enjoy. I talked with R. Paul Wilson while we were at the Winter Carnival of Magic, the last one, and I say last one, not only the most recent one, but the last one number 50. And last week we spoke with Tiffany Savage, and next week we will speak, I'll tell you in advance right now, we're going to be talking with David Da Vinci, who was the illusionist, or as he calls himself, a thrillusionist, and he will be our guest then next week. But this week we are going to be talking with one of the people who was one of the performers and lecturers at this year's Winter Carnival of Magic and has just a fascinating life and career and stories to tell. So I'm going to let this go. This is a little bit longer than usual, and I was going to break it up into two episodes. I put that out on Facebook and asked whether or not this should be into two episodes of shorter length or just let it go long. And almost 100%, I think there was only one person who had said, no, break it up into two. But everyone else had all said, no, just let it run. So here it is. I know you're going to enjoy it in its completeness. And let me say also, when you think it's over, it's not. And that's why this went on a little bit longer. It kind of surprised Paul, too. So please welcome my guest this week, Mr. R. Paul Wilson, here on The Magic Word. I am here this afternoon with my friend, R. Paul Wilson, who is from, are you from Glasgow? Is that right? From, or what?
I live in Glasgow.
Live in Glasgow, yeah, but that's not, okay. So we'll say that's where you're from.
Okay.
But definitely Scottish, mm-hmm. and grew up in Scotland and has developed not only a fantastic magic career, but also in the film industry, which I want to talk about also because I love film. And he is a creator. He's a writer, producer, director, and has had his hands starring in some movies like Shade, mm-hmm. and working with Smoking Aces, which was, I thought, one of my favorite films. Actually, Shade was really good too, with Sylvester Stallone and all that. But I remember seeing a show that was The Real Hustle. And you also had Scammed and Takedown, which were also some shows that mainly just showed kind of in the UK, wasn't it? I think on BBC. I don't know. Did it have worldwide release? Or?
Scammed and Takedown were US shows.
They were US.
And did not show in the UK at all. And Real Hustle was a UK show that didn't show in the US at all.
That was the one I guess I was thinking. Because I remember something had to do like with the being a fishmonger or something, you know.
Amongst many, many, among many others.
That was one for whatever reason that had stuck out. Maybe that was the only episode that I saw when I was over there or something. But anyhow, he is someone that I run into from time to time, and I'm sure you do too if you ever go to Magic Live. He is always over in the workshops there with Jason England and some of the other hardcore guys teaching you some of the best stuff. Also appears at other conventions, been at the SAM and run into him then at Magi Fest and I don't know wherever. I mean, I go to a lot of conventions. It seems like that Paul's always there. In fact, I remember a couple times we've just been waiting, standing next to each other in line for Magic Live.
Exactly. You know? It seems we've done that like half a dozen times.
It does.
So I don't know how we coordinate that, but we should keep doing it.
We should indeed. And so we are here now actually at the Winter Carnival, the 50th and final Winter Carnival in Pigeon Forge, Tennessee. And so please welcome my friend, R. Paul Wilson. Hey there, Paul. How are you, sir?
I'm very well.
Good.
Very well.
Good. First question is, since it's your first initials, is R. Mm-hmm. And so let me guess, is it R for Raul? So you're Raul Paul? Or
you know what? I may actually make a change. That's pretty good. I'm Ronald Paul Wilson.
Ronald Paul Wilson.
And I've always been Paul. My father apparently just decided Ronald Paul was rolled off the tongue better rather than Paul Ronald, but always been Paul. Mm-hmm. I guess I was born in the time of the Beatles. So, you know, of the four choices, I didn't score the losing choice. I don't know if there's a lot of Ringos around, but I got Paul. And of course, so did my cousin. And so did pretty much everybody born that year. But yeah, Paul. But Ron Wilson, who was a really good friend.
Yeah.
Got it into
the uncanny Scott.
The uncanny Scott. And he got it into his head that I had changed my name because there was already a Ronald Wilson. Mm-hmm. And it didn't matter how many times I told him, no, I've always been called Paul. And R. Paul was just a really handy way of writing because, you know, all the other work I do, there's a lot of Paul Wilsons around. But he always called me Ron. And so I stayed with him. I stayed at his house for a while as well, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, wake up and he said, morning, Ron. I say, morning, Ron. But, you know, But I've always been Paul, and really the R. Paul is not so much an affectation, although I'm sure it is. It's just a very useful way of identifying my work against the F. Paul Wilson, who I'm a big fan of, an author who's mm-hmm. out there, and Paul Wilson, who wrote a book on how to be calm, which is definitely not me.
You seem to be a very chill guy.
I'm pretty chill, but if I were to write a book on calm, I think that would be a grand lie. I'm maybe calm on the surface. And a bunch of other Paul Wilsons were out there, musicians and stuff. So our Paul Wilson just tended to be quite useful. And also it means I can be called Paul, R. Paul, R. P. P. You know, so and I think somebody tried to call me R once. I didn't understand. But yeah, it's a very complicated answer. Very simply, I've always been called Paul. My son, we also use his middle name. And I don't think he's ever forgiven me.
Was your father that way also? I mean, was...
No, it just happened in the registry office. Just
I see.
Paul Ronald became Ronald Paul. And
yeah. But I mean, as far as his name, if he went by his first initial...
Always by his first initial, yeah. Okay. It just happened that I looked into it. But I can feel everybody tuning out of the podcast right now.
No, I think that's interesting. I've always wondered that. And I was I was thinking actually Ronald or Rolando. And I thought, that's not right. But Ronald and Ralph were a couple that came to mind. But I thought Raul sounds good. Raul Paul.
Yeah, Raul Paul. I might actually do something with that.
That's... Speaking of kind of a Spanish E, have you ever gone over to Escuela to Magic with Juan? I assume you have been with Tamara's.
Oh, yeah.
A few times?
Yeah. I've spent 30-something years in and out of Spain. Mm-hmm. I'm a massive Spanophile. I speak enough Spanish to be dangerous.
Do you?
And, you know, obviously, you know, I've just spent 5 years making a movie in Spain with Juan. And, you know, it's...
I saw that picture that was on your website of him sitting in a restaurant in black and white. I love that type of black and white photography. And
yeah, I mean,
you have a good eye.
Yes, just one. We haven't figured out which one yet, though. But that picture was kind of the beginning of the journey we've taken, and that was 7 or 8 years ago, maybe even more. But that was around about the time we started talking about making a documentary together. And trying to do something different because he didn't want to do a standard documentary, and neither did I. And but around that time, my family and I would always go every year to Spain, and we would go. We have a lovely place that we stay at.
What part of Spain? Near Madrid, or
well, the place that we stayed at is just outside of Granada, and it's in the Lecrin Valley. It's beautiful, and it's a beautiful townhouse in a lovely old village with a swimming pool on the roof and, you know, amazing views. And we'd go and stay for 2 weeks there and then we'd do a quick little tour and go home. And 1 year, the people who owned it needed it and we had to not go that year. And Juan happened to be in Edinburgh when I found out. And so I told, because we were planning to be there and then drive over and see him. So Juan invited us to his house where I also spend summers at his house, you know, on my own. In Cadiz, and he invited us over, and so we all went and we spent 10 days or something based with Juan, and it was great. My kids love Juan, my wife loves Juan,
and his wife is lovely,
and Consuelo. Yeah, Consuelo's always treated me like family. I mean,
and then she do most of the cooking, I guess.
Well, you know, Consuelo's a really amazing cook, but she doesn't cook very often. What she tends to do is she cooks at special occasions, or occasions where, you know, maybe going out is not appropriate that night. And I would quite often fly from Scotland to Malaga, and then it's a 2.5-hour drive from Malaga to the house. And so I drive, and I get there about midnight with a couple of stops or whatever. And you get there at midnight, Juan be waiting for you at the door, and, you know, take you in, and you go through the garden, you go up, it's now midnight, and the smell hits you right away, and you realize,
she's been cooking.
Dinner's on the table. And and if Consuelo cooked dinner, it was, you know, the first time that it happened to me, I had, you know, I never failed to amaze myself at how stupid I can be. And, you know, I can't remember if it was the very first time I ever went there and had a car but it was a long time ago. I got there, I got in the car and then drove. And I thought, well, it's almost 10 o'clock at night and I still haven't eaten because of the flight and the times. And I stopped and I had a meal somewhere, like a McDonald's, but not a McDonald's. And I had that and I said, okay, so I've eaten. And then I got to the house about midnight and there's dinner on the table.
And yeah, because they eat at odd hours.
Well, yeah.
I mean,
but
for me.
I should have known better, but I get there and dinner's waiting for me. And so I have to eat another meal, which was painful because I was full. But she's an amazing cook. And you know, it's a special occasion when she cooks. So whenever I'm there, I'm always hinting. You know? Well, I don't know. Those potato dishes are much better when you make them. I remember, and you know,
yeah.
Maybe she'll make it that night. But it's a special place. I've been going there for a very long time. It's had a massive influence on me, as a not just magic wise, but in other ways. And that photograph was, we all had dinner, and we had dinner in his favorite restaurant and my favorite restaurant, El Faro. Which is a wonderful restaurant, even on nights when it's not great, because it can be, you know, not as great as it always is. But even the place, the atmosphere, the feeling, and the food is all wonderful, but the company makes it.
That's what makes it special. Course.
So we had just had this wonderful meal, and we all got up and we backed off, and I had asked Juan if I could take this picture. It's a special camera called a Widelux. Which doesn't have a lens on it, has a little turret that scans, and you get this wonderful wide image. That's not a cropped image. That is the image that we took, which is why it's distorted. And you know, this camera is supposed to be for landscapes, but it does these wonderful, big, wide movie cinematic images. And I said to Juan, when I got there, I was really hoping we were going to be seated in one of the alcoves, and we were.
Mm-hmm.
And so that way I didn't have to move Juan to the alcove. So that was the table we had all had dinner at. And I wanted him to be alone at the table. Because for me, that's a magical time. If you find Juan alone, because he's always surrounded by people.
Correct.
You get to be at the table. But Juan was like, I don't like this. I like to be surrounded by people, and I'm Andalusian. And we had this, not an argument, he never argues, but you know, we had this thing, but this really isn't me. And I said, no, but I think it is you. And then I asked him to look up and look over to the right at the picture. And he looked up and I took the picture. And I think it took him a while to understand why I made him look like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I won't explain it, but if you understand anything but a Renaissance art.
Yes. Yeah, I know what you mean. The triangular.
It's triangular, but it's also about inspiration and, you know, not just divine inspiration, but, you know, creativity and all that.
And the
that.
Lighting is important.
And I very specifically wanted to stage it that way, and he did it, and then we talked about it. And that was kind of the discussion of how I wanted to make him uncomfortable in terms of revealing him as a person, as a magician, as an artist, as a, you know, as a mentor. And I think that was the beginning of a long and wonderful, but also, you know, a relationship creatively that there was, if I ever said, let's just do it, he would do it. And if he said, I don't want to do it, I would not do it. But in the middle is this discussion about everything. And that's very much in in tune with the Spanish vibe, which, you know, is wonderful, but it isn't exclusive to Spain. All of that stuff exists here and everywhere else, but it happens a lot more there, and it's more common there. And so, yeah, I've been around the Spanish school for a very long time.
And so when people go to the Spanish school, I mean, like you and Jason and Gary Plants and different people and Steve Beam or whomever, and it goes all night. It's not like, I know, constantly doing card tricks. It's mostly probably talking and getting to know each other and then sharing magic also.
It's magic is a huge part of it. Magic is this kind of fulcrum on which everything turns. But
okay.
It does lead to lots of other conversations. And so some of those conversations are, you know, about magic itself.
And inspiration and theory.
Yeah. And some of that stuff touches much wider range of topics.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we will talk about cinema for hours. And Juan is a real cinephile. I'm a cinephile, but I can't compare to Juan's knowledge.
Really?
Juan's knowledge goes much further back than mine. And so I end up usually coming back from Spain with ideas for tricks, maybe some tricks he's shown me that I might want to play with and do or whatever. But then I also have a list of movies to watch, you know, that he's... And quite often he always says he was a bad filmmaker. I don't think he was a bad filmmaker. I think he found making films to be frustrating and long.
But he did do some filmmaking? I did not know that.
He's trained as a filmmaker. He trains as a director.
Really?
See the movie, you'll learn all about it.
Well, I'm looking forward to it.
but he said, you know, I made films and I didn't frame it properly and I didn't do this and I didn't do that. But I really think at the heart of it was that it was creatively restrictive to him because, you know, there's so many parts in a movie.
And he can't control them all?
Well, it's not even controlling them all. It's just there's so many pieces you have to move that are that other people, you have to have other people do things.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that kind of leads to where you are. And making a film is a very, very complex and time-consuming and immensely frustrating and rewarding
process. Who's it the hardest for? Is it for the director or for, like, the screenwriter who is trying to have this adapted to film? In other words, if you have an idea of something and the director is a different direction and he's, I mean, I would think it'd be a little bit of a fight, so.
There are fights. There are fights. But you know what? The movies I've made, I've written myself all but one. But when I do take on a picture, I take on a creative level of control, which usually starts with whatever I'm given. If I'm given something, I look at it and go, okay, I like this. That's why I want to do it. But I want to do it. Therefore, I need to come at it differently. And it may just be a case of rewriting the script from a visual perspective to so that I can include how to do it. And as I'm doing that, I may make some changes.
Well, ultimately, it's a director's decision,
well,
isn't it?
Not ultimately, the director's decision. The director's decision. There are three phases, really, to making a movie. I mean, or more, but there are three. The first one is the writing, and the writing should be as good as it possibly can be. And then you have this thing, which is really, really good. And then you pass it over to a director. And if it's a real director, and that, by that I mean somebody who's not just taking a job and doing what they're told, there's nothing wrong with that. That's a business. Television is based on directors who have to do that because there's a consistency, and producers
right.
do have a creative vision, which has to be.
They got a cookie cutter stamp. They know what they want and everything, and they replicate that. Sure.
In film, though, I think that if you keep doing that, you end up with Marvel, right? Which is great for a while, and then suddenly it becomes, oh, this is very plastic.
Pandemic.
Because you know, your money's the driving factor, and, you know, you're trying to capture the widest possible audience. Whereas at the beginning, you just had some really good filmmakers making some really good films, but they were also making very entertaining films. And it's the same when you get a script. You know, you want to be able to say, okay, I'm now the storyteller. You were the storyteller. You've given me a story to tell. I'm going to tell it with my medium, which is now, you know, camera and working with actors. And the actors, of course, now have a role as well. So, you know, I said there's three, there's four, because the actors must, if you're, I mean, not everybody wants this, but you want the actors to come in and surprise you, not all of the time, but some of the time. You want them to breathe life into this so that you can, so that what you're looking to capture is better than you could have imagined.
That's why casting's so important.
Casting is everything. And it's so important, because if you get actors who are too pliable and will do everything they're told, you get one type of film. If you get actors that are maniacs who just want to do what they want to do and just sort of kind of ignore the material and come up with their own stuff, then you get another type of material. But when you get that beautiful conflict of visions, and then, you know, what happens is never is not a compromise. What happens is a collusion, a collision that becomes a collusion.
Okay.
And it's that collusion of perspectives, and if you get it right, then you get wonderful, wonderful, wonderful pictures. And if you get it wrong, you get a picture. You get, you know, usually fine, but sometimes it's just,
you get movie magic.
Yeah, and there's always this thing about, you know, nothing great ever comes from a happy set because there's no conflict.
What do you mean by that? I mean, like, well, it's just a family. I know that they all kind of work together. And
yeah, and most of the departments are, you know, got their own pressures. They don't need to make any more. But there is this thing, you need this kind of conflict or so that you have a resolution. And the resolution creates some kind of product, right?
But you wouldn't want to create that on the set.
Well, you don't want to create it on the set. It's just, you will, you know, I worked with an actor on my last picture who came in with a crazy idea of how he wanted to present the role. And it was completely wrong. And the problem I had was that it was not something we could compromise on. It was not something we could meet in the middle on. It was not something we could work with, because he'd come at it completely the wrong way.
Gotcha.
Now that's something that I take some responsibility for, but I have to let him talk the entire idea out. And we have a set, we have a limited amount of time. I have to let him talk the entire idea out and then say what it is that I feel is wrong with that idea without telling him he's wrong. And
it's a slippery,
it's a slippery thing. And and so, you know, where we do that, it's not in his trailer or if he had one, you know, where we do that is important, how we do that. And, you know, how we get to the point where I can say, no, we're not going to do that, but you're not going to be pissed off and that's going to come out in your thing. Although it wouldn't have hurt in this scene because he was yelling at a kid, but it was what he wanted to do would not have been in tune with what he did later. And he did fantastic work in the film ultimately, but that guidance thing, if you have an actor with, and this is a very experienced actor who could have pulled, not rank, because, you know, I wouldn't have taken that, but who could have, you know, pushed him harder. He was very professional, very respectful. And I think he felt I was wrong until it came together, until he saw.
Then he saw your vision.
Until he realized what was wrong about it when he was in the position he was. And then he was running with it himself. And then he could say things like, you know, I remember he had a personal issue at home because, you know, he got a phone call and he was a little upset about it. And I said, well, I'll try and get you out a little sooner. But, you know, when we got to the set to the scene, I said, you know, that feeling is really, you know, in tune with what we're doing here. And it's in the film. So, but you have to be able to work with somebody like that and respect their ideas, even when their ideas are completely wrong. That means that it's not always going to be a delighted experience or a delightful experience. And sometimes it can be a horrible experience for some people on set, but the product is fantastic. Mm-hmm. And it would not have been fantastic if everybody was singing songs and holding hands. But that's because it's a creative process, and a creative process is about people bringing something to the table, and something has to be made out of that.
Yeah, because you're working with a lot of A-list type of actors, like I mentioned, Sylvester Stallone and so many others that you've had, and some I'm sure are easier to work with than some others.
I've been very lucky in the films that I've been allowed to work on with these guys, you know, really great actors. I can think of one very, very famous actor who just was not very pleasant, but she wasn't pleasant to anybody, to be honest.
Not just to you?
Not just to me.
Okay.
I mean, I was doing nothing directly with her anyway, so it wasn't really my issue. But I think that, you know, part of that is fear on their part because they're committing something to film that will be there forever.
Mm-hmm.
And they're working with people that they don't know yet or that, you know, they're, and especially if they're only in for a couple of days, you know, so there's, you know, it's hard. But Stallone was, you know, a delight to work for from my point of view. And, you know, whether we were working on the, you know, the scenes that we were doing or whether we were working between scenes on some of the stuff that, you know, I was directing some stuff on that movie and I was also the advisor. So I was helping him with.
You were second unit director on that
one? I was second
on Shade?
Unit director.
Was that Shade? That.
Yeah, yeah. Damien Neiman, who, you know, just kind of offered me the chance to do that and to do it on many different ways, you know, directing, you know, the opening titles, obviously, the pickups, whenever anything needed to be refilmed, we'd keep Little Bart's studio. Sometimes it was just, you know, inserts of people moving cards or looking to see what their hand was. And sometimes it was an actor's glance or something and they'd come in and do it. And, you know, but generally speaking, I think that it's about being professional, and a lot of really big actors expect that from everybody and come, Stallone knew all his lines and he knew everybody else's lines, did not need to look at sides almost at all. Other actors did need to look at sides, but they didn't let that get in the way of what they had to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody's different. And I think that usually if you're dealing with a negative experience with someone, you got to understand there's a lot of fear based on that, and part of that fear is that I'm inexperienced compared to them. They've done 20 films this year, I've done 5 in my entire life, right?
Yeah.
So I've got to be firm, but at the same time I've got to be fair, and I've also got to be communicative and empathetic in a way that will allow them to take some chances, and when they take chances, to know that, well, they don't know, they'll find out later, to hope that I will grab the good stuff and the good stuff will make it and that they won't be looking at it later and going, you know. And I just guess that happens a lot. And it happens with good directors because, you know, sometimes you have to use the take you take for reasons that have nothing to do with what the actors did. But that being an actor, being in front of the camera, which I've also done, is extremely brave.
Yeah, didn't you star in another movie that was, I've forgotten the name of that, Isolani.
I didn't star in that movie at all. I directed it. I wrote and directed
it. But you were in, you acted in it too. Acted and directed in that one.
No, I try and stay on the back side of the camera because that seems to be my best side.
Okay. Did that do well in the box office or BAFTAs or anything?
It did very well with some quite big awards, but BIFA, which is the British Independent Film Association, their awards, they nominated us for the Discovery Award. We didn't win, but we, if you look at the other four films that are up with us, they were all, you know, they're huge indies, and
big,
and mm-hmm. we were in there. We were also nominated for Camera Image for the cinematography and for directing, so that was...
Have you ever worked with Andy Nyman?
On film?
On film, I mean,
on
yeah.
On film, no. I mean, I've known Andy since we were kids, but mm-hmm. no, not on film. I would love to, but, you know, that's a different...
Kind of does what you... Well, actually, he does more writing and...
Well, Andy's a director and a writer and an actor and a singer and, he's a massive, massive talent. And I think that...
Yeah, he was just in the West End when I was there. I think he was playing Fagin and Oliver or something. No.
He's on Hello Dolly at the moment.
What was it?
Is it Hello Dolly?
What it was. Sorry. Yeah.
And I can't remember what's he about to do. I heard he was going into something else. But, you know, he's amazing. I bought a ticket to go see him in Fiddler on the Roof. And I was in London and then something came up and I had to go home. Anyway, I missed him in Fiddler on the Roof, which would have been great. But yeah, he's a great talent. But again, you know, he's a very, you know, he's a good friend. I like him a lot. And if I thought he was perfect for something and I went after him.
You might consider that having him in a movie.
Oh, 100%. But then I have to remember this is a guy that works with some of the greatest directors of our time and is a good director as well. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to take that into account. So, you know, the fact that we're friends now is not meaningless, but mm-hmm. it's like, yeah, now we're working on a different level. So I don't know, that would actually scare me a little bit because, you know, it's hard to be yourself at the best of times, but it's a little easier with people that don't know you personally. Because, mm-hmm. you know, I'm a different person away from set. I'm not as, at set, I try and be available to everybody. Mm-hmm. And in my personal life, I'm very, you know, I'm a little bit more reserved, even though I'm talking a lot because Scott gave me whiskey before the show, which, you know, which probably means my Scottish accent might be apparent, but.
Well, it's the Scotch whiskey that makes you speak some a little Scottish.
Yes, that's called a slur. Yeah.
A slur.
Yeah.
A couple different questions. Going back with Juan Tamariz's movie, tell me how that's coming along, when you think that might be released, or is it in production, editing, where are you now?
The film is finished. It's edited, it's colored, it's the music is done and the sound is done. We have a little bit of graphics work we're going to do because a friend of the production who's really been marvelous throughout the whole production has a really interesting idea to help us with some of the couple of the images that we want to use are, you know, the photographers are very expensive and we want to use our photographs. It's kind of expensive. So instead we've gone down a slightly more artistic route. And so we're waiting for some of that to happen and then that'll get dropped in. But the film is done and we're, you know, we had this enormous hill to climb in terms of the copyright issues because we'd used so much television that Juan was in and images. And so
that could get to be pretty expensive and a lot of hurdles.
Yeah. Well, we started with a Kickstarter. The Kickstarter, you know, it did very well, but we didn't hit our target. And the target was
really, that's kind of surprising.
Well,
because the movie that Sean Farquhar was working on and those guys about that, I mean, they hit their goal and exceeded it.
Yes, but their goal was quite a bit shorter than ours.
Oh, okay.
And we've already spent, you know, a large amount of money making this film over the last 5 or 6 years. And Rob Solomon, who's the producer, has, you know, raised and invested money and helped get it done. And then, you know, we had agreed a very, you know, fair wall to where that had to end. And we made we made a film, I think, worth much more than we spent on it because of the way that we made it. And but part of that was we have to kind of just tell the story we want to tell and make the film we want to make. And then we're going to be left with this legal issue of clearing all of these clips.
Mm-hmm.
And
then, they're important. I'm sure you're looking at and saying, can we afford this? Or if we leave it out, what will it do to the film?
You know, I mean,
a lot of decisions.
One of the things that I think I've been very lucky in this film is that Rob has basically just said, I've been responsible. I haven't gone overboard, but he has basically said, you know, tell the story you want to tell the way that you want to tell it. And we've done that. And we had
Rob the producer?
Rob Solomon, yeah.
Okay.
And so we've done that. And now, but we also now say, this is what we've used. This is exactly what we've used. This is exactly what our liability is. And if you add that liability up to the very top version of how much they might charge you, that's what we were looking for in Kickstarter. And we were advised, don't ask for that. That's too much. Ask for a third of that. And then when you get that, you'll attract more people into the project, you know. And people who do Kickstarter, they understand this world way better than I do.
Yeah, I don't.
And I said, no, frankly, because the last thing I want is only half the money and not be able to deliver. I just can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
If you give me the money, I want to be able to deliver on that. So we don't make what is the real target. A target like this makes no sense to me. And I'm still not entirely convinced it would have been the right thing to do, but people I trust say that you probably still would have gotten to your target, but probably doesn't work. What we did do from that is we did get a couple of investors who called us and said, well, how can I help?
That's great.
And that has gotten us into the position where we are
now. That's what you want.
Well, yeah. And not only that, you know, I mean, it's never going to make millions. It's a documentary.
Yeah.
So and it's not even a documentary. It's a portrait. So it'll make what it makes. And, you know, we've got a few bills to pay. I've never made a single penny off of this movie, and we'll probably just find our audience and then it'll exist, but it'll be a very worthwhile project, and hopefully we'll pay back the initial investment, and then hopefully we'll pay back some of the other investment.
I know they have documentary festivals and all that in different places where that you can take the film around, but you'd call this a portrait. I haven't heard that term applied towards the film before. Is that, I assume there are not portrait festivals or?
No, I mean, it is, like, technically it's a documentary. You have people talking about a person, and
sure,
you have a person talking about his work, and you have, you know, clips and all this stuff.
That is
a documentary. But one of the issues with documentary was that I had envisioned doing it in a way where we had a crew, where we had a budget, where we had a broadcaster behind us. You know, it would have been made, and then the broadcaster would broadcast it and sell it, and that's how it would have been done. And that was all in the works when October 2019, we had meetings about that. And in that year, we sat down with Juan and we said, okay, so this is where we're going to go. This is the target. And Juan was hesitant. He was thinking, maybe we should do this ourselves, you know, maybe. And I said, well, yeah, but, you know, I don't know. And we were talking about it when the pandemic hit.
Mm-hmm.
And shortly after, you know, all the lockdowns and stuff, so I don't know, maybe June or July, Juan and I jumped on a Zoom call. And for no reason other than my head was shifted into the, you know, the fears that the pandemic rose in all of us.
Right.
I'm looking at Juan and I'm worried about him because he's older than I am.
You mean his health? Well, isn't he diabetic?
He is diabetic. He's been diabetic for a very long time. His health's always been, you know, an issue for him in that way, but his energy has always been so wonderful. That, but he, I just thought, I need to make this film and I need to make it now. And I have a bag of lenses from when I made Our Magic and other, you know, shorts that we did. I've got like my kit, right? But when you make a movie, you have crew. And I have a first AD and I have a cinematographer and I have, you know, sound guys and I've got a script supervisor and I've got an assistant. I've got a team. And then they've got people and that's all great. But suddenly I just realized it's me and it's nobody else.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as we were able to fly, I had a ticket and I flew to Spain and we I said, we're going to do one interview. I envisioned us doing seven. We did nine. And a long form interview where Juan talks directly to the camera about answering questions about a very specific range of topics that I had decided.
Like what, for an example, overview?
If you'd asked me this a couple of years ago, I would have resisted answering.
I understand.
I would have resisted answering because I wanted it just to be there without being overt about it. And then when the film was ready and done, I wasn't terribly happy with it. I wasn't happy. This is 2 years ago. So about 2 years ago, we felt the film was done because Juan had a health issue. The health issue meant I felt we'd run out of road. We couldn't really interview him anymore.
Yeah, he wasn't going to be traveling anymore.
Yeah. And, you know, if you've seen Lost in the Shuffle, he was, you know, that health issue is very apparent there. Sure. But Juan got treatment, and the treatment is fantastic. You know, he is back to the Juan that we know. And so I thought, well, we could do more. And I started to think about how I wanted to present it. And so I kind of took the format and made it more overt and followed a journey with him. And so Juan has a theory called the Seven Veils of Mystery. And the Seven Veils of Mystery, which he talks about in Our Magic as well. There's like a little animated text segment with music with Juan talking about it. But Juan's really exploring the relationship he has with an audience and the relationship actually we all have with other people, the things they sense from us without understanding how it is that they can feel these things. And so Seven Veils of Mystery, I felt, was a great way to then explore Juan himself and to get to, you know, Juan is a very, very famous person, and more famous than people really appreciate, to be honest.
Throughout Spain.
Yeah. And, you know, he is genuinely beloved as well. So
I always felt he was kind of like the Paul Daniels of
Paul
Spain.
Was great. And I grew up watching Paul, and becoming friends with Paul was fantastic, but Paul was never loved. Not remotely like.
Really? Okay. Like, I mean, I've heard that. The person you love to hate.
Well, not even like that. He just was, you know, he was very popular and he was very funny and people liked him and people knew him and he was the magic guy. And people did love him. I mean, they love watching him. They love going to see him in shows. He sold out theaters up and down the country.
Sure.
But what I mean by loved is Juan is loved in the way that I believe Mr. Rogers was loved here. Right? That connection is what people, when people come up to him, they hold their hand to their heart.
Well, they see Juan.
And they're, I'm watching them have the same conversation he's heard a million times. You know, they grew up watching him with their family. And when you watch the film, you realize why that was important, because Juan was one of the people that came out of the period immediately after the dictatorship, when television and everything started to change. And television, which was very gray and authoritarian and controlled by the dictator, suddenly was becoming a little bit more free and a little bit more easy. And here comes this guy on television, and he's not wearing a suit. He's wearing jeans, and he's got long hair.
Yeah, and he's kind of goofy looking, wearing a hat. Yeah,
and he's amazing, and he's also smart, right? That's the other thing, too. He's funny, he's amazing, and he's smart, and you can feel it. And so he represents a period of time where people came together and also embraced their own culture. And, you know, Spanish culture is very, very, very rich and deep and interesting and fascinating and goes way beyond what most people understand, certainly way beyond what I understand. But Juan is connected to all of it in little threads here and there. And then he also represents this, you know, the Mandragora, which is a bar in Spain, in Madrid, you know, where musicians would come and sing folk songs that would essentially challenge the status quo. And, you know, they would punctuate the change in culture that was happening. And on one night a week, Juan would come in and do close-up magic, and people would gather around and have this amazing energetic.
Wow.
If you've ever been around Juan, not watching him on television, although he's better on television than he is on video. Like magic videos, I always think, are terrible. All of us are terrible in magic videos, because even the very best one doesn't represent what being in the room with that person.
Nothing like that, and especially around Juan. And Juan, when he has people around him, especially.
Yeah. That energy is amazing.
I've been there.
You don't capture it when you see it on video. He did a very good job of capturing that on his television shows, because that's exactly what he did. He surrounded himself with people. And so those people's energy and their faces and their reactions was translated through the screen. Because Juan, despite his, Protestations is a wonderful filmmaker, and he realized that in order to communicate through the screen, he had to show them what to relate to. And now Danny D'Ortis does the same. He brings people up.
I was gonna say, Danny's got people all around him too,
right?
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Danny does the same. Woody Aragon does the same, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
that's why I thought it was more of an Escuela kind of method of doing magic. It seems to be Juan-ish, I guess.
Yes, I mean these guys do their own stuff too, but and also you got to remember that Juan is only one part of the Escuela de Magia de Madrid. Ascanio,
and Rafael,
Juan Anton, Camilo Vasquez,
mm-hmm.
the group that was there, that they all got together, and at one point I think Juan wrote it, but they all signed a manifesto about cultivating the next generation, about sharing with people who, you know, need that information, not holding back, not doing what, you know, the sort of classic secrecy thing, you know, about keeping mm-hmm. secrets mm-hmm. away from people.
Right.
They wanted to make sure that they were available to the right people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, who you were and who you knew wasn't what decided that. It was, you know, what you were doing and what you were passionate about and what you needed was what was determining that. And that still exists in Spain. And, you know, I think that you have this culture of sharing was so important. And it's important in the movie. It was so important that if I had somebody say, well, you know, they, I don't know why they were arguing, but they were arguing that maybe that's not the best way of doing it. And I said, look, they made this decision to consciously help the next generation. Now look at that next generation.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Right? Look at what happened from that.
Sure.
And then that next generation is also doing the same. And I see places where it may be stopping, where, you know, what I would call, although Spain is a Western country, but where I might call like Western selfishness, you know, where people become more guarded, like, you know.
Want to keep their secrets, and it's like, yeah, our pet effects, you know, I'm not going to share this with you.
A roadblock, and,
yeah.
You know, it's like, well, what Spain accomplished is what happened to a lot of those very secretive people when they got older. They suddenly became more available and they suddenly wanted to find places to share that material.
But they were sharing them with people who appreciated it and wanted to learn, as opposed to exposing things to the masses.
Or just giving it away. And, you know,
right.
I mean, a little bit of your, you know, magic soul feels like it dies sometimes when you give something away that's really good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, But
especially something you worked on all of your life, but that's the way you grow, because after you have shared that with someone, it's like, then it almost forces you to become more creative in your next endeavor.
It does. But, you know, one of the things that really kind of encourages you is seeing somebody do it and do it well or even have fun with it and be passionate about it. That always makes me feel better about releasing stuff. You know, I was talking to someone earlier, you know, I brought out a trick recently that I've done versions of for years, and I think this is absolutely the best version, and I love doing it, and I love doing it in this way, and we released it, and I've had people write to me and say it's fantastic and they love it. That's great.
Mm-hmm.
But then somebody says, oh, someone's done a really negative review of this, and I said, well, they're entitled to their opinion.
Sure.
But, you know, I mean, not everything is for everybody. But I think that when people say they're enjoying it and they're doing it, I actually get more of a kick out of that than having stuff that they don't know about. Whereas before, I used to have this kind of, oh, I've got a secret thing about, you know. And in a way, that's just a sort of, I think we all go through a period of that. But now I think one of the Spanish lessons has always been that, you know, when we do Escorial, which I've gone to for many years, again, 30 or so. In Escorial, there's kind of a no egos approach where you can ask anybody anything.
Everyone's on the same level, kind of the salt's in the middle of the table kind of a thing.
Yeah, and people come who've never been before and open up
mm-hmm.
in ways I've never seen them open up.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to name names, but one of them is a famously secretive guy, a lovely guy, but famously secretive and guarded. And he came and he sat down and he just open the books. What do you want to know? You know, and it's wonderful. And I think he became more like that when he left. you know, maybe not with everybody, but he certainly became more open when he left, because I think it's more rewarding.
That's one of the reasons I like to attend the 4F convention, because that's one in which the people who attend are invited. Just like that, I'm sure Esquelia is something that you just can't apply to like a school, and but there's something, it's an invitation, and one would say, hey, we'd like for you to come to the school or something. Likewise, mm-hmm. you're comfortable with who you're sharing it with, what I'm saying at the 4F convention, because you know that they're on a certain level. You don't have to say, here's yeah. how you do a double lift, or, you know, here's a bottom or whatever.
And there's a trust thing as well, you know.
There's a trust thing, exactly.
You feel like
they're not competing with you. You understand. They know the ethics, and they understand that there's a family.
It's really wonderful when you can take away that layer of competition. Mm-hmm. And you know, we had an incident many years ago, just after an Escorial, where a magician came through Madrid. So Escorial is the name of the town, which is outside of Madrid, 30 miles outside, I think, maybe even less. But it. We all come back to Spain on Sunday night, and we all have a big dinner that night somewhere. And because this magician was in town on a lecture tour or something, he joined us. Mm-hmm. And there was something going around that had been shared, a really marvelous idea that nobody had ever seen anything like it before. And it had involved a physical object that, you know, everyone had one.
New method, new concept,
new everything. And it was a wonderful thing. But when they handed it to this person, there was a real feeling of,
oops,
this is not the person to show this to, because that could go anywhere.
I understand.
Whereas there was no feeling of that ever. But also, you know, that person brought a competitive nature to the group that was out of tune with everybody. Yet everybody who I've ever seen come to Escorial has been, you know, wanting to be part of the party and, you know, take part and be involved. And where are your priorities? What are you doing all this stuff for? And do you belong in a group where people are willing to just literally open up any secret and share it with you? Mm-hmm. Those places are very rare, and they probably should be rare. Mm-hmm. But that culture makes magic better. And everybody who takes part in it in a positive manner.
There are so few places that are like that, though.
Yeah.
And I say places, I know there are roundtables in different groups in parts of the world where they get together for lunch once a week or month or whatever, outside of like a club meeting or something, in which some guys who are serious about whatever will sit down and share ideas and say, this is what I'm working on. And say, well, you can improve that if you do that. What if you did this or that, or use this joke with it or something?
It's funny you bring that up. You know, that's really interesting, because I think clubs are so important, because that's where the filtering process starts, you know, where the relationship starts between generations, which is so important in magic, younger and older. And, you know, and what tends to happen is you have, you know, branches of magic represented in ways that you might not expect. You know, in Madrid, for example, although, you know, Madrid is obviously a little special, it's got all these wonderful magicians, but, you know, the club in Madrid, they say, and is a wonderful club with wonderful magicians. But in Spain, at one point, you know, the old guy who was like older than everybody, who was, you know, was Fraxen. You know?
Yeah. Cigarette guy.
Well, cigarette guy and newspaper
manipulation
and many other things. Yeah. But, you know, and if you ever, and Fraxen's, we talk about Fraxen in the film too, because, you know, Han talks about three of his mentors in the film. And I think that Fraxen, when you see him, we have some film of him, he lights up, like, you know, he lights up the stage. He lights up as a human being. You almost don't need to put a light on him. He seems to be emitting it. He's so alive up there. And he gave Juan an amazing piece of advice, which again, you have to see the picture to hear it, but it's an amazing piece of advice about why you're up there and what you want from it and how important that is. And what it really is that you're doing. And then, but that's because they had Fraxen. But in...
Not everybody has that it factor.
Yeah, but in Scotland, we had Roy Walton.
Roy Walton, exactly.
Right? We had Charlie Cameron in Edinburgh, who was the godfather of bizarre magic.
That's right.
Mentalism. And he was just Charlie, right? Mm-hmm. But I would spend hours sitting with Charlie. And then, of course, Pat Page, who lived in London, but spent a lot of time in Scotland. I would go to conventions where Pat had his little booth to sell his products, which are fantastic.
Yeah.
And his family, by the way, still sell those.
Correct.
Even at Blackpool. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these are great, great, great tracks. But during the Eastbourne and Southport IBM conventions, the dealer's room was deserted because of the events. People would be at the events.
Okay.
So for, I don't know, 60, 70, 80% of the day, nobody would be there. So I would go down, spend my money, get a room, a terrible room in some squalid, awful bed and breakfast, and whatever I could afford.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd buy a registration. I'd see absolutely none of the lectures. I see absolutely and none of the shows. Except for the competition, which was always a lot of fun to watch because half of it was terrible and half of it was great. But I would spend all the rest of my time sitting with Pat and getting him cups of tea.
I can see why. I'd spend time with him too.
Yeah, but
he's invaluable.
You're just talking, telling me things and making fun of stuff I was trying and, you know, correcting and, you know, giving bits of advice in his very, you know, sarcastic and, you know, and that time was brilliant. But again, that's that thing of that in these clubs, Edinburgh Magic Circle, there was Len Edwards and Sunny Day, two fantastic magicians. Neither one of which most people have ever heard of. Certainly not Len Edwards, although Len Edwards is wonderful. But then we also had Roy Scott. Roy Scott famously saw Tamaris do a trick on television and said to, I think it was me and Peter Duffy the next day, how fooled he was by it. And Peter said, but that's your principle. It is? He says, yeah, that thing that you put in the gen.
Yeah.
And he went, oh, so it is. And it was so well hidden.
Oh, wow.
But Peter had identified it, right?
Yeah.
But Roy Scott had come up with that. And you know, Jim Boyd, who's still at conventions, Jim Boyd invented the hopping halves.
Hmm.
And I love watching Jim go up to tables and he lets people try and pitch him his own trick. You know, but people think that trick went way back, but it did. It went way back to when Jim Boyd invented it. So we, in Scotland, we were very lucky. And then you go to England and you've got Alan Allen and you've got, you know, Ali Bongo and Alan Jackson.
Alan Jackson, right?
And then you go to France. So in actual fact, the clubs are really important because it introduces you to these people and it allows access not only to younger generation to getting advice and help from the older generation, but for the older generation to find the people who are willing to, the sponges who are willing to soak this stuff up and take it in their own direction, sometimes do it entirely as taught. But I think what you're listening to me doing right now is I'm realizing that everything that's wonderful about Spain, which I said at the beginning exists everywhere else, I think it exists in a lot more places when there's a place for people to come together and to share and to spend time and then benefit from that.
That's good advice for people to join clubs because today I don't believe that this generation is a joiner generation. That's why you're seeing a lot of fraternal organizations, I don't care, like Lions Club or JC's or whatever, I don't think that they have the numbers they used to. And likewise, I don't believe magic clubs have the attendance that they used to, and particularly with the younger people.
Yeah, you know, I go through phases where I think like that. But I also, the way we learn magic, the way we access magic has evolved over time. And the internet makes things very different.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, it's both. It's both.
Good answer. Good answer. It,
you know, we always used to say exposure wasn't a harm because exposure, you know, it doesn't linger. People see how a linking ring is done and they, you know, but then they see someone do linking rings and they go, well, that's not how I saw it. Even it might even be the same method. It's just done so well.
Right.
But now people have the ability to locate anything immediately and find out.
So in real time, while the person is doing it on stage, they're Googling it.
Correct. And that's a real issue. And I think that whenever I see a magician, sometimes very good magicians, and not bad people, decide to teach tricks, there's a layer where you kind of have to stop there. There's a layer of free entry to magic where you should be able to say, look, if you're interested in magic, here's some stuff. And the reason magic sets are all the bloody same is because, you know, we've given those over to that side of the line, right? if you want to continue to the other side of the line, you had to buy a book. You had to get involved, right?
Right.
You had to get more deeply involved. Now you can just look up more and more videos, because if hits are important and people realize that by doing this thing, which everyone has said is wrong, and they said it's wrong for a very good reason, but getting hits is more important to you, then that's a really easy way of doing it. And an easy way of doing it will always attract the wrong types of motivations. And so whenever I see anybody doing that, I have kind of a zero tolerance.
So what do you say about it?
To them, nothing. But, you know, I wouldn't encourage anybody to book them for a convention. I don't see why you should lift our skirt and then get to come to our party.
Yeah, good point.
Right?
Yeah. Because they are...
And if they cared about that, then that's good, because then they would stop, maybe. But if they cared about that and then continue, then it's not... Something's very wrong there. And we know the people that I'm talking about, because you've talked to them.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes, I have.
And I feel very strongly about that.
Yes.
I feel very strongly that you were right to talk to them.
Mm-hmm.
I feel very strongly that you... Well, I also feel very strongly that you let them off the hook.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah.
And I feel that I want nothing to do with those people.
Yeah.
And I just don't think they belong in our company, because their motivations are either false or... They're selfish, and they are selfish, right? You know,
they're motivated by the profit, because obviously the hits are turning into dollars.
And that's what I keep hearing is, yes, but look at what they've been able to buy with our ideas, right?
Mm-hmm.
And okay, fine, but let them do that. They can do what they want. It's a free world.
Mm-hmm.
Why do we have to have them in our company? Because that's the thing that you should be giving up.
I see.
Therefore, although not necessarily, but you are essentially strangling some of, you know, you're souring the milk a little bit, right? You know,
And strangling creativity, because some people are just going to say, if they're going to be exposing that, then I don't need to be contributing. I mean, you look at people who have contributed really good ideas that decided, if I'm going to be ripped off by, that's a different issue as far as being ripped off versus being exposed, but still, if they are, it's like, why should I continue to do that?
Well, yeah, and I say you can stop, but, you know, if I did this purely for the money, I would go broke. I know people who can make, you know, tons of money selling magic, and I know a few people who can do that without standing on anybody's toes or taking anything they shouldn't, and those people are geniuses, you know, I mean, marketing geniuses and, you know, sometimes magic geniuses as well. But I do it because I enjoy the process of sharing it, and I enjoy contributing to the people who are looking for something. But I also kind of enjoy showing off how clever I think I am, because usually someone will come around and say, I know you think you're clever, but here's this manuscript from 1923. And you go, oh my
Put
goodness.
Put you in your place.
And quite often, you know, that can be done for absolutely anybody. But
yeah,
I do think that the process of sharing this stuff and, you know, the marketing of it, it's nice. You know, you sell stuff and people are willing to buy it. That's all very good. But as I said, you know, again, going back to the trick I was talking about earlier, I said, look, I very much like every single thing I've shared.
Mm-hmm.
It's something I've put more than just a paltry amount of effort into, and then some graphics and some marketing, you know. By the time it gets to that stage, I've done a lot of performing of it. I've worked with it. I've played with it. I feel it's ready.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that piece. That piece is something I do and would do. And that's the only razor I've got to judge anything that I put out.
Mm-hmm.
I like it. Therefore, you know, and sometimes, you know, having put all of that work and all of that effort and all of that time, you look at it and go, wow, I mean, that's a really good deal to just get it, right? But then people look at the packaging and go, I don't know. Right? So that stuff is all weird and frustrating, and, you know, and I don't like the process of magic reviews very much. There's a couple of really good magic reviewers out there.
Mm-hmm.
And not that I've watched a lot, and there may be more than that. But the bad ones, or the one, not even bad, they're still doing good stuff. But the ones that talk about it and kind of get enthusiastic about it and imagine how they're going to use it and start to think about it beyond the level of competence, right? In other words, they look at it and go, wow, I could do this with it. And I can see this is where the work is required. Where some people get to that point and go, well, this requires work, therefore it's terrible. Or I don't imagine myself doing it, therefore it's terrible.
Right.
Magic's a very difficult thing to review because it's such a subjective thing.
It is. It's just like art.
Yeah.
I mean, I've talked with people about competitions, about, you know, your perspective or subjective opinion of what is considered art and that someone's act is different from someone else's, just like a painting on the wall. Or a movie.
And some people are ahead of their time, and some people are only for a few, right?
Right.
Some people are, and some material is only for some people. But I do think that magic is one of those things where I don't care who you are, you like exploring and playing with new secrets, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And therefore, when we go to Blackpool, had you been to Blackpool before? Was that your first?
Yeah, this is my third one. I just went to this year.
Well, I've been going forever. I mean, I've been going since I was 16. Blackpool is this enormous marketplace, and it's easy to make fun of.
Mm-hmm.
But I go around and I, you know, if I take the time to stop and look at something, most booths have something of interest there. Mm-hmm. There's a guy called Astor.
Who's I know Astor. Sure.
Astor's.
I was going to book his lecture tour, and then COVID came up.
Oh, well, yeah. But his stuff is always like, oh, wow, that's great. Oh, that's great too. Oh, this one's great too.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just one great idea after another.
Kind of remind me of Kovari.
Yes. You know, he's a modern, prolific, genius creator of really clever solutions, mm-hmm. but they're also practical.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
commercial.
Yeah. And he'll tell you, I've probably brought, I don't know, 50, 100 people to his booth to see him do that mental epic that he has.
So different.
Yeah. But not only that, no forces. Right?
Yeah, correct.
They choose everything.
Correct.
And you go, and I go, well, that's
they
great.
They go, what?
That is great. And it's so wonderful. And I've never bought one. I should just buy one so I could do it for myself. But I love taking people. I took Matt King over and I watched him and he was like, oh, wow. And it's such a great thing when he flips that over.
Yeah.
Astor, there's another guy and his name escapes me, but he has this really fantastic finger through bill. And, you know, I got one of those from him, and I used to do it all the time. But every time I went up to his booth, he had stuff not packaged very well. You know, homemade packaging.
It's funny how packaging makes a difference.
It does now.
Today.
It does now.
When Banachek and I had put out Psychokinetic Pen, it was just in a Ziploc bag and a Xerox instructions.
And you know,
we sold thousands of those.
And you know, I bought hundreds of them and sold them in lectures.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a whole routine with Psychokinetic Pen. It was built up to it. And so I used to buy those, and the ones that you made it probably, Ziploc bag.
Which is why my fingers don't work, because I was making these things popping out it's a long story, but my hands don't go together, my fingers, because of making those pens.
Really?
Yeah. I stripped the tendons. I mean, because you had this dowel rod and then put the Bic pen on there. I'm trying to get that blue tip off, you know, because they use a different kind of glue. Mm-hmm. I stopped using the original because people apparently were stuck on the end of the thing and they're going to choking. It was a choking hazard. So Bic made them differently. And so I made this thing that I can kind of pop this thing off. But as I was doing that, I went through about 500 or 700 of these things and then realized the next day I just had it permanently damaged my finger.
Wow. Wow. You know, another trick that I used to... There's been a few tricks that I've bought and taken on lecture tours just because I thought they were great. Like, what's his name? I always get one name in my head and I forget. Joe Mogar's little set
knives?
Of knives.
Yeah.
That little set of knives. I took it to Japan and sold it around Japan with a really simple routine that I put together. And I got to the end of the tour and I was with Shigeo Furugawa, who's one of the modern masters of magic. You know, he's just fantastic. And we were standing on the train station. I was going to continue back to Tokyo and he was going, I think, to have a walking vacation with his son. And he asked me, he said, can you teach me a trick? And can I record it so I can learn it? I was like, yeah. And it was the sequence for the knives. And I didn't even know what I had, you know? And
funny.
And so, but those knives were so good, you know, those knives were so
well
good
made.
And so well made. And another trick that I absolutely adore, and I've still got a couple of them because I do it whenever, if you're at my house and you ask for a pen, there's a chance you're getting some kind of gaff for a trick. And the bending pen that Cornelius brought out.
Oh, yeah, John.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you remember that? So you had the solid pen and then you bent and it would bend.
Sure.
And then it would come back and you give it to them and they couldn't bend it.
Mm-hmm.
That was a kind of a terrible trick to sell to magicians because they kind of looked at it and went, well, I don't know.
But you did for lay people,
it was fascinating because they saw it bend. I saw that bend, but they're not sure.
Yeah.
And that's a wonderful place to be. So,
yeah.
Yeah. I always, you know, I'm always thinking about the lectures I saw as a kid before things were so commercialized, and they just are now. Where packaging is so important. Like some of those reviews, well, not the good ones, the bad ones I've seen, spend half the review talking about the packaging and barely mention the effect, you know?
Mm-hmm.
The guys that would come around, and Lee Earle was one of them. Every couple of years, he'd turn up with a set of those notes. And I've got so many lecture notes from that period. I'd see every lecture that came through town. And what you were hoping for was that they'd bring something that you'd never seen before because we didn't have the internet. We had magazine articles.
Right.
And, you know, Joe Givens. Yeah, Joe Givens came through town and he did his lecture and he had won FISM couple of years earlier.
Yep.
His lecture was great and it's still great. And I've still got those notes and they're still great.
Yeah, good stuff.
And, you know, he and I have sat down and I keep telling him how great that lecture was and, you know, his matrix with the buttons and then the buttons are sewn on in the corner.
Sewn on, right.
You know, it's all terrific stuff. That was much more exciting to me than going around Blackpool where you're overwhelmed.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking today about one of my favorite techniques of Steve Forde, and others have used it as well, which is, you know, I'm show you 100 things and explain all of it so you remember none of it.
Right? That's true.
I feel like that in Blackpool. I walk around that room and I feel numb.
You can be, and you forget everything. It's again, you know, usually I think we can handle about three things. And after that, if you could do four, it's an overload.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't see what I think is one of the great tricks there, which I saw on video afterwards, which was the teddy bear out the back.
Correct. I saw that same thing. Actually, someone told me you ought to go see that, and I didn't get around to it, but I saw the video on that, and it's pretty amazing.
It's fantastic. And, you know, I mean, it sold out immediately.
Mm.
But I can't imagine myself doing it. But
it's not my thing.
I tell you what. You know, if my kids were young, I'd have just bought it. I've got puppets that we used to play with the kids with. So I think that was there, though. That was there. I was at Bon Lee's stand and said hello to him. He's a great magician from Hong Kong.
Yep.
But I didn't stop and look at that, or I wasn't curious enough. I was numb by the time I got around to there. And I think that those lectures where people would come through town. Again, Leal was really clever because he had this magazine, I think called Synergy.
Yeah,
and correct. Synergy had all these great contributions and he would basically make a deal with the contributors to add it to his lecture tour.
Mm-hmm.
So he didn't have to come up with like eight great things.
He was teaching other people's tricks.
And his own too, you know what I mean? I learned the Synergy from him and years later we asked him to come and teach it at the clinic because I still think it's one of the great Synergy.
You think it's better than Richard Osterlund's?
I do. But I think that if you ask somebody else, they might tell you different.
Yeah, it's whatever.
I learned both of those. The thing about Lee Earle's is that part of it is so ingenious and clever.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, I also like Ron Pink's. I think that's good too. But, you know, and I like my own.
Acidus Novus works for me.
I'm not an expert on Synergy, but, you know. But Synergy, the technique is only so much. You know, one of the great techniques for things to do with Synergy is to try and do it in such a way that this makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And there's only a couple of things that resolve that. Burning them, for example.
Correct.
You know, you tear it up and then you burn them and then you look into the ashes and then you take the ashes and rub them on your arm.
And make it a,
you know.
Right.
So all of that kind of, so the ash pen. Remember the ash pen?
Sure do.
That little nubby little bit of soap or whatever it was.
Right.
You know, I would have a rolled up sleeve and I would have the ash pen here and would literally pull up my sleeve as I was standing here. So my sleeve was like halfway up my arm, but nobody ever noticed.
Right.
And I would be drawing this thing on my arm where I was talking to them. And then, you know, we'd get to the other thing and then I'd get to the point where it was burned and then you'd read the ashes and you go, look, I think, let's have a look. And then it would appear on the arm. And that sequence was just so fantastic.
I know we could talk for a lot longer. This is
I don't know what time it is. Oh, it's rushed by.
Well, I specialize in rambling, incoherent conversations.
Which is why I let you go.
And I guarantee nobody's with us right now. Everybody's either asleep or left or, you know.
I'm confident they're going to go back and listen to this a second time also.
Just the Arpa Wilson thing. If they made it past that, they get an award. Anyway.
It was excellent. So cheers. Thank you very much for joining me. And of course, this is called The Magic Word. And I always close by asking my guests what it is. It's your magic word. What's your philosophy of life? What's important to you?
I know we're already taking a long time getting here. At the beginning of the film, Our Magic, I asked the question of everybody, what is magic? And the only person who had an answer right away was the only person who I'd given warning to so that he would have an answer right away, because I felt, and that was Max Maven. And he already had thought about it, but he gave me a concise answer. Everyone else, I told them nothing about that question.
Yeah.
So that when I hit them with it, I wanted them to reveal the depth of the question.
Because that's kind of what I do. That's why I don't tell them in advance.
Right. And I sort of feel that the less important or the less you know about something, the easier it is to come up with an answer that's, you know, like that, snappy and related to something. So, I mean, there is only one word that comes to mind, and it's hard to just say it, because it, rather than explain it, to preface it with everything that is both slightly cliched about it and everything that is deep and meaningful and thoughtful about it, whatever you read into it, you're probably right. And so really the word is love. It really is. And, you know, and I hesitate because maybe there's something clever. You know what? You asked me what the magic word is. It really is just that. So the magic word is love.
I love it.
I'm sure 50 people have given you the same answer, but that's it.
Well, they've had variations on that. I'd probably say maybe out of the last 900, that may be less than a dozen actually have used that. So that is somewhat original. So I think it's very important, but not necessarily a recurring theme like I thought that it might be. I mean, you know, family and different other kinds of things, you know, might come in.
All of that. And that's the thing is when you say
it's
what's the magic,
encompassing.
When you say what's the magic word and I know it's love, I go, well, how is that going to be interpreted? And then I realize just thinking about it here, actually you can interpret it any way you like, you're probably right. But yeah, it is love. And to end on this, the way you think and the things that you think have an enormous effect on everything. And that's just true of life. And, you know, I think that one of the things I did years ago was I took 3 post-it notes and I put them on my wall. And the 3 post-it notes, and there's one word on each one that says, make good art. And I fail and succeed at that on various levels ever since, but it's always there and it's, you know, always somewhere where I can see it.
Omnipresent.
And it's basically like that's an expression of what is it you want to do? What is it you want to accomplish? Make good art. And what is art? Well, that could be one of 20 things, a magic trick, a movie, a story, a piece of writing, a photograph of Juan in a very rare moment, right? All of that just is there. And it doesn't matter what people think about it, because along the way, I love doing it.
Yeah. That's your passion. Yeah.
Here we are.
That's all said. That's enough said. Thank you very much. I appreciate it, Paul.
Great.
This has been great. I've enjoyed our time together, and I look forward to spending the rest of the weekend here, spending with you as well.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. I mean, never been to Pigeon Forge before, which is...
It's not someplace on the map that Scottish people would normally... stop off.
You know, we were talking as we were driving up the main sort of street here, and I was like, hey, there's an upside down building over here, you know? So I think
the Titanic down there, yeah.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's like, you know, okay, so, you know, obviously King Kong's in the building over there. I was like, you're right. Why? But, you know, obviously we're finished, but the amount of times in my life, you know, Eric Mead and I once sat out on Juan's porch after talking late into the night. We were talking about the 7 veils. It was the first time that Juan ever raised the 7 veils with us. And Juan went to make himself some lunch or something, because you gotta remember, Juan starts with dinner, has lunch about 3 in the morning, and has breakfast before he goes to bed.
Right.
And we were sitting there, and we're just sitting enjoying the moment. But we're also thinking about what we were said. And I look over and Eric looks at me and he says, card tricks. Card tricks got us here. We're sitting on a porch in Spain talking to one of the great masters of the world at what he does. Mm-hmm. He's also one of the nicest and most loving people in the world. And, you know, whatever we ate that night would have been fantastic and wonderful. And then, sure, you know, we're in this fantastic part of the world. And it's because when we were kids, we picked up card tricks, mm-hmm, you know, and other things can do that. But I think magic does it in a way that, you know, it brings together people and places and times that people outside of magic can't really understand. That some of us, I mean, I'm now in my 50s, but when I'm in my 20s and 30s and some of my closest friends are in their 70s and 80s, that's really unusual.
Mm-hmm. For most people, but not within our profession.
Yeah, and I have friends who are, you know, financially not very well off at all, and mm-hmm, are geniuses, mm-hmm, and some who are, you know, captains of industry and flying around the world and
haven't finished high school.
And all these kinds of crazy people. And then I've got, you know, I get to talk to kids who are got this amazing perspective that I had at one point from a different time and a different perspective. And would be resisted by the older generation almost, you know, or discouraged even, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm like, you know, this is great. You know, show me something else. What else are you doing?
That's right.
Yeah.
And I'm still like a child. Fantastic.
But yeah, and you know, but then, you know, then the other side of that is that I recently picked up the guitar. I'm rubbish. I have a guitar in my room right now. And I can't not practice it. I am fascinated by it, but I'm genuinely...
Interesting. Never too late to start.
Yeah.
Could be the piano or whatever else.
Right.
Or,
well, we have lots of music instruments in the house. My son plays fantastic guitar. My other son plays fantastic piano. And they both play a little bit of the other. And I just decided for some reason to pick it up and play and noodle around and then start watching YouTube videos,
mm-hmm,
and then getting better and then start to realize, oh, I need to maybe join a course. And then, so I'm into the course, but then I'm kind of swallowed up by the technique and I'm not learning any songs. And so now I need to rehearse better. And
yeah.
And then I go, whoa, what is this telling me about magic? Cause it is telling me an awful lot.
That's
a
very good point.
Right.
Is applications. Yeah. The crossover.
Right. And not only that, I have no intention of getting up on stage with my guitar ever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So why do I love it? And why am I doing it? Why do I love, you know, mentalism? I don't ever want to be a mentalist, but
creative.
I love reading about it. And I love, mm-hmm, coming up with ideas. I love finding where it can cross over to magic. And most of the magic I do is for friends and situations that are personal. The shows I do professionally are rare. And I think that music can teach us an awful lot about magic, but it teaches us one thing that's really important, which is magic's more difficult than music.
Mm-hmm.
And you tell that to anybody who studies music and they're going to look at you like you're out of your mind.
Right.
Well, here's the thing about magic and music. Music, you always know how big that mountain is. And it's a big mountain. It's a bigger mountain than music, than magic for sure. Music is a bigger mountain, sure, than magic. But you always know where you're at. And you always can see the peak is still way, way off.
Step,
if you're ever,
yeah,
going to get there, nobody ever gets there, right?
Yeah.
But you still know how far up the mountain you are. You can see how far you can. You can see, oh God. Magic's not like that. Magic is just full of little ledges where you constantly think you're at the top. Mm. And, you know, if you're
it's
not,
like this is it.
If you're not driven,
yeah,
to keep climbing and to try and get to the next part, you know, the next layer is behind you and you're kind of looking at, you know, so magic is this thing where you can get really far, really fast in terms of appearing to be a very good magician,
mm-hmm,
which is wonderful in itself, but to actually try a little harder and go to the next level. Those stages are you have to consciously go after them. So to be good at magic requires a much more conscious effort than it does with music. With music, you kind of have no choice. If you know, you can stop and be good at whatever you've learned, but you know, you always know there's that thing there that maybe I should spend some time on that. So magic is harder to be good at than magic is harder to be good at than music is the accurate way of putting it. Because you can get much further. If I could be as good at music as somebody could be at magic within a couple of months of just doing some general practice, that would probably take years.
Correct.
Years.
Yeah. I see your point.
But magic gets you there so quickly that you then become restricted by your own accomplishment. And, you know, that's enough. And you can stay on that level just buying tricks and doing, you know, but the next level isn't, is, you know, and the really the top levels have got nothing to do with sleight of hand and technique. And, you know, I think that's really a very interesting way to look at it. And I like theorizing a lot because I think I can help people who have other motivations, whether it's doing magic personally or whether it's being a professional. And when I work with professionals on TV and, you know, as a producer and whatever, and director and all that stuff.
Well, I'm going to say that this has been an additional epilogue.
Are we still recording? I thought we stopped recording.
No, we didn't stop yet because that was excellent stuff. And I'm glad I kept that on. So I'm going to turn this off.
Yeah.
But thank you very much for joining
me. All right. I thought we were just talking.
No, well, we were. and that was more of what we were just doing. Thank you very much. That was our Paul Wilson for The Magic Word. This is Scotty out. I want to thank our Paul Wilson for being my guest here this week, and I want to thank each of you for tuning in and listening to this episode. I know you got a lot out of it, and we went into a little bit more depth at the end there, and even, as I said at the beginning, we surprised Paul by going on a little bit longer when he thought that we were actually already wrapped up. And I was going to edit that out, but I thought the conversation he had with Eric Mead and some of the other bits of advice and stories he told were part of the gold, I think, in just having a conversation, which is what this podcast is all about. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I enjoyed having an opportunity to sit down and chat with this fine young man who is so talented. And I am, it was an honor just to be in his presence and to hear the stories he had to tell. So again, thank you very much, Paul. And so we've had kind of a longer episode, so I'm going to wrap this up quickly and just say until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember to make good art. This is Scotty out.